So what kind of thinking would we lose if women didn't go into science?
Did you ever see that movie, Forbidden Planet?
Explore all the wonders of a vanished civilization.
That's one of my, 10 most favorite movies.
What is it, Randall?
Sir, radar just picked up something.
There's this invisible monster, and when he walks...
This way, sir, slowly.
The earth trembles, but you can't really see him or her. Well, that's the way it is when an adult male orangutan appears in the trees. You know what it is. You know it's an adult male orangutan. And you know that he's relatively benign.
It's still coming!
You can't really see him clearly, but you can see the trees shaking and the earth kind of moving, and you tremble. I mean, it's involuntary in spite of yourself, even though you know it's just an adult male orangutan. Trees crashing, branches falling, and then he gives forth the long call. The long call is really an awesome sound. Almost like a locomotive when a locomotive goes by. I mean, it's so powerful that you can feel the vibrations just go through your body.
No, it's stopped now. We'll check over the whole system first thing in the morning.
Aye, sir.
One of the most famous scientific experiments of the 20th century was a series of pioneering field studies of the great apes. And these studies were all done by women. There was Jane Goodall studying chimpanzees, Diane Fossey with mountain gorillas, and Birute Galdikas with orangutans. And these three women, the so-called trimates, were personally chosen by the legendary paleoanthropologist Louis Leakey. And Leakey had a theory. He thought that if we could get really detailed field studies of the animals most closely related to us, we might discover how our own ancestors evolved. He also had another theory. It should be women, not men, who did the research. Steve Paulson has our story.
Today, Jane Goodall is one of the world's most famous scientists. She showed us that chimpanzees, like humans, have very different personalities, and she made several revolutionary discoveries. She found that chimps are toolmakers. She observed them hunting other animals, and she also saw them wage war on rival groups of chimps. But what may be the most surprising piece of this story is that when Goodall started her field study in 1960, she had no scientific training.
Didn't have any. None. I was at school. I left school at 18. I got a course of training as a secretary, got a job in London with documentary films, and then decided I had to get to Africa when I was invited by a school friend. So left my job in London, which didn't pay very well, went home, worked as a waitress, saved up my wages and my tips, got a return fare to Africa, and there I met Louis Leakey.
Well, I have to say that is remarkable when you think about it. I mean, back in 1960, you seemed to be the most unlikely candidate to revolutionize our understanding of chimpanzees. Why do you think Louis Leakey picked you to do this field study?
Well, he told me later, afterwards, that he deliberately picked somebody with no scientific university training because he wanted to send somebody into the field with an unbiased mind. And of course, back then in the early 60s, the ethologists of Europe were very reductionist. Humans were the only animals with personalities, minds, and above all, feelings. And of course, I hadn't learned any of that, so I went merrily ahead and gave the chimpanzees names, which wasn't at all appropriate. They should have had numbers, and described those vivid personalities and described many examples of clearly intelligent behavior and emotions that were obviously similar to or sometimes the same as ours.
About 5 years after Jane Goodall went to Africa, Birute Galdikas got the idea that she wanted to study a different great ape, the orangutan, which eventually led to her own meeting with Louis Leakey.
When I was 19, I was sitting in a very large psychology class, and the prof just sort of mentioned the woman living with chimpanzees, and I just knew that this is what I wanted to do. Orangutans had not really been studied in the wild very well. And there was a sort of this history of people going out and looking for wild orangutans and not being very successful at finding them. Because of this, over the years, there was this sort of mythology that had arisen in academia. And this mythology basically was that it couldn't be done.
How did you first meet Louis Leakey?
I met him again at a lecture at UCLA. And I just went up to him after the end of the lecture and started talking to him.
And you told him that you were the person that he should send to study orangutans.
Well, I didn't quite say it that forcefully, but I said, I told him that I wanted to study orangutans and asked him for his help.
Well, he had a whole theory of why women would be better field biologists, didn't he?
Oh, he was absolutely convinced of it. He felt that women were much more patient than men. He felt that women would not excite the aggressive tendencies of the great apes as much as men. And he really believed that women were more perceptive than men.
He deliberately chose women. He felt that women made better observers and he liked working better with women.
Was he right, do you think?
Well, if you look at women in an evolutionary perspective, you find that, and I compare them with chimps, chimp mothers, human mothers, that a mother would need to have been patient, otherwise her children wouldn't do very well, and they don't with chimps. A woman needed to be able to understand the needs of a non-verbal creature, that's our children, before they can speak. And also women traditionally, even if they've been subjugated, have been very quick to recognize the little communication signals in a household so that they can prevent arguments happening before they blow up, keep children out of the way of irritable men.
You know, I think he may be right, at least of women in our society, in that tests repeatedly show that women do see details that men don't see. So I'll give you an example, an experience I had. I was once at the home of an internationally known primatologist who happened to be a man, and I was looking at a picture on his wall, and I said, these particular primates, you know, engage in male-male competition, fight a lot. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, look, you know, the finger of one of the males is missing. And he looked, and he'd been studying these primates for a year. I mean, there was a picture of them on his wall. And he looked at me and he said, funny. He said, I never noticed that before.
That's amazing.
Yeah, he had never noticed that part of the finger of one of his study animals was missing.
Now, these were revolutionary discoveries. I mean, for instance, when you saw a chimpanzee using a tool, can you describe that first day that you saw this?
Oh, I can close my eyes and, as I am now, and just see it. I was a bit cold, it had been raining. I was pushing through some tall grass. And suddenly I saw this dark shape hunched over the golden soil of a termite mound, and I peered through the bushes with my binoculars, and the chimp had his back to me, but I saw a hand reach out and pick a piece of grass, and I could see him pushing it down into the termite mound. And the next time, a couple of days later, not only did I see him using the tools, but actually stripping leaves from a twig, therefore making a tool. And that was the exciting thing, because up till then, it was thought that humans and only humans used and made tools, and we were defined as man the toolmaker.
One reason Goodall and Galdikas made so many groundbreaking discoveries was simply the amount of time they spent with the primates they studied. Goodall lived at Gombe in Tanzania for 15 years. Galdikas stayed at her campsite in Borneo for more than 30 years. This was not the way male biologists had typically done their field work.
Basically, it's get in there, get the data, and get out. And I think women have a different attitude. The data is not necessarily everything to them. I mean, I don't want to give the wrong impression that, you know, all male scientists are like this and all female scientists are like that. But basically, I think we're speaking about different acculturation processes. I've noticed that the male scientist frequently will get the data and it will almost be like a trophy. It'll almost be like a scalp. And Louis Leakey really zeroed in on that difference.
Well, you tell some remarkable stories about one orangutan whose name was, I'm not sure if I'm saying this right, Sugito?
Yeah, Sugito was my first ex-captive, wild-born ex-captive.
Who just clung to you all the time, no matter what you were doing, whether you were taking a bath, whether you were trying to change your clothes in bed when you were sleeping at night.
That's right. That was exactly what he did. Orangutan infants, like all primate infants, are very needy, and they have to be on the body of their mother.
And he would urinate on you throughout the night?
Yeah, and throughout the day as well. Defecate. I was covered by tropical ulcers. My body was covered with tropical ulcers. It wasn't until years later that I figured out the reason I had all these tropical ulcers was because I was always wet with urine.
You write that your relationship with Sugito became so intense that it really was the most important relationship in your life, with the possible exception of your relationship with your husband.
Oh, that's very true. It was very intense. And in fact, I think this intensity is what caused problems in the relationship with my husband, my then husband.
Mm-hmm. And I would think it would be hard. I mean, here you had this baby clinging to you at night, you know, here, and your, you know, husband is sleeping beside you. And
yeah, he couldn't touch me.
Sugito didn't especially like your former husband.
No, it was. He was just insanely jealous. And, I mean, the relationship was that intense.
There was something else that set both Galdikas and Goodall apart from their male counterparts. Both became mothers during the years they spent in the field, and they raised their children alongside the apes they were studying.
Do you think your experience as a mother helped you as a scientist, as you were trying
Definitely. Yeah. I understood, like, for example, when a chimpanzee mother is approached by another one and she gets all angry if the child's asleep or something, I felt exactly the same. That these surges of irrational anger if something happens that you think is going to harm or disturb your own child. And so I could much better understand the mother chimpanzees when they behaved in what seemed to be the same way.
And then you had a child of your own. And you were raising him out there at Gombe as you were doing these field studies. I guess it raises the question of whether you learned anything about raising your own son from the chimpanzees you were studying.
Well, I'm quite sure I did. I mean, I really looked on Flo as a role model. She was patient and supportive. She was protective, but not overprotective. She could impose discipline when she wanted. She provided a nice, secure base for her kids. And she supported them if they got into difficulties. That's the hallmark of a good human mother.
Well, there was another convention as well in science. I mean, to some degree, it's still there, but I'm sure it was even more prominent back in the early 60s when you were just starting out. And that's that scientists were not supposed to get emotionally involved with the subjects they studied. And it seemed that you kind of violated that rule in your study of chimpanzees.
Well, of course, I didn't know that when I began. I hadn't got any degree of any sort. I'd just done biology in high school. That's why Lewis chose me, he says. You know, I've watched animals all my life, long before I watched chimpanzees. And I think that having empathy with the creature you're watching is an immensely powerful tool. It gives you a platform from which you can start asking questions.
I think when you do field work, you basically not only experience the science and the animal that you study, but you also get to experience yourself. If you don't understand yourself, you can't understand the animal that you're studying and how to study that particular species.
I was sitting in the forest with David Greybeard, and I picked up a fruit and held it out to him. He turned his head away, and I put my hand closer. He turned, looking directly into my eyes. He reached out, took the fruit, dropped it. He really didn't want it. And then he very gently squeezed my hand, which is how chimpanzees reassure each other. And so in that moment, we communicated with a language, or communicated in a way that seems to predate words. Perhaps in a way that was used by our own common ancestor millions of years ago. And it was an extraordinary feeling. It was bridging these two worlds.
It felt like interacting with equals. Because they were so smart, but yet at the same time, the world of the orangutans rests on such different assumptions about what is important and what isn't. And it's so slow-paced. It's hard to explain, but it was like going into another universe. When I think back about those early days, I tend to forget, you know, how sick I was, and how thin I was, and how weak I was, and how hungry I was. But I remember how happy I was.
That audio is from interviews Steve Paulson did with Jane Goodall and Biruta Galdikas about a decade ago. Coming up, restoring the history of women in science, one Wikipedia article at a time. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX.